Welcome. I'm so glad everyone's here. My name is Tina Grego. I'm the news editor of Style Weekly. I'm relatively new to Richmond, and more to the point tonight, I am a native New Mexican, like our esteemed office. Reading this, I was curious, we talked about this, how a person who grew up in the high desert could conjure a world and marvel that she could conjure a world so full of water. I wanted to tell you just a little bit about agent and editor P.J. Carter. Sarah McGrath. Sarah McGrath is vice president and executive editor of Riverhead Books. Prior to coming to Riverhead in 2006, she was senior editor at Scrivener, where she worked for 8 years and acquired and edited a combination of literary fiction and narrative nonfiction. PJ Mark is vice president at Janglo and Nesbitt. He's been an agent since 2002 and has been in publishing since 1993, and he also works with literary fiction and narrative nonfiction. I'm really excited to sit here and have this conversation because if you have, well, you just got a sample of this book, if you have not read it, beautiful keeps coming up a lot, and it is beautiful, and the words are wondrous, and tonight we get to talk about story, and we get to talk about words and the power that they convey, and it is, as I think it was NPR said, it's these little perfect little jewels of sentences. If you have not read it, you can buy, you can have your book signed. We welcome you to do that. So without further ado. One of the things I was thinking about, and you spoke about how the genesis of this book begins with your grandmother's stories about your great-grandmother.
Yeah.
So you went to New York for 2 weeks, and you interviewed your grandmother, and these were taped conversations. But one of the things I was thinking about is, I kept picturing the younger Ramona, who was listening to these stories from her grandmother, and how the stories came to inhabit you. And when you left New York with the tapes, and you went back and you transcribed the basis for your story, what happened to the stories?
What happened first was that I wrote everything down. I did the true just transcription, and then I started writing, but really, I was basically still writing it the way it had been told to me. And my grandmother's a really good storyteller, so it was good, but it was her voice, and I didn't really have any place in it. I gave up. I thought it wasn't going to work. I thought, oh, I guess maybe, I don't know, it was too hard, too big a project, too much about the real thing. I wasn't going to be able to find my way through all of those facts into the story that I wanted to tell. So I put it down for 2 years.
How long did you work on it before you put it down?
I worked maybe close to a year or so, maybe it might have been a little less, 10 months or something.
One of the things I was curious about, you conceived of this from the beginning as a novel.
Yes.
And there is a part in the beginning, and it's also in the end, where you say, ours is a story, I know both the parts I saw with my eyes and the parts I did not. And you went on to say, someday your children will ask what happened and you will tell a new version, and this way the story will keep living. The truth is in the telling. And as I read that, I thought, many a memoir has been written under that kind of wide umbrella of emotional truth.
Mm-hmm.
Was that never a consideration for you, and why not?
No, it wasn't. I think part of it is that I knew I didn't have nearly enough information to even begin to think of an entire book of nonfiction. I could have written an essay, maybe. Also, I don't like doing research that much, and you really have to do a lot of it if you're going to write a book of nonfiction. I like doing a little bit, and I like kind of the stuff that gives you a sense of the place and images, but I'm not interested in fact-checking a million thousand times. That's part of it. It's just what made me excited was the idea of the story, and I knew the fastest way to get to that was through my imagination. Once I figured it out, once I got to that point a couple years later when I picked the book up again, and I realized that if I wanted to know these characters and I wanted to figure this place out and I wanted to understand something about how they survived this, I was going to have to do it. No one else was going to be able to do that for me, and I was going to have to give myself some room to imagine it and trust that was legitimate.
Your background is, you're a poet.
That's how I started, yeah.
And so you've been writing poetry for how long?
I have been writing poetry for, well, 6 years.
So you're writing poetry for 6 years, and then you decide to move from poetry to a novel. And I'm curious about how your poetry, and working as a poet, what that transition was like, how it helped or how it hindered you.
Yeah, well, I'll tell fiction writers all the time to read poetry. I think it's one of the smartest things you can do, because just getting right to the emotional core and these things that go through your body without you even noticing that it happened, and sort of economy and all that. So I think I learned so much of the stuff I know how to do in prose from poetry, but you are right that it is a lot more pages. And I did have a feeling of like, oh no, I can't do this. And I had, well, after that first 8 or 10 months, I had maybe 60 pages or something, which seemed like the most pages I could write. I had already done the marathon. I couldn't go any farther. So when I started graduate school that following fall, I went back and wrote short stories for a couple of years, which I hadn't really ever done before. So I even that felt like, well, 15 whole pages, all right. Let's see what we can do here. But, and then after a few, then the novel was a little bit less intimidating after writing stories for a while and having a sense of how that arc works. And
yeah. So that's what I was wondering, if writing short stories was then a kind of the transition, the bridge.
Yes, absolutely.
You thought you needed to go back in.
Although I wasn't even thinking, I truly thought the novel was done and dead and gone. I thought I would have completely given up on it. So I was writing stories because I wanted to be writing stories. And then a little later I got brave again and thought I could try it, see what happened.
So I have a lot of questions, but I want to bring you into the conversation as well. So I'm going to fast forward a little bit, but remind me to go back because I want to talk to you about the drafts that you did. At what point did you two become connected, PJ? And I'm curious, when you first saw the manuscript or pages of the manuscript, when you read that, was there a point where you just said, "Ah, this is true, this is real, this is wow"? And if so, what was that point?
My heart is actually beating because I remember the moment that I read the manuscript, but I came to Ramona through her stories first. She, an editor, had told me about her work, and she was in New York meeting with agents that were interested in her work through the manuscript of stories that she had written. And I really loved those stories. It's this book that came out second. And I think through reading those stories and talking to you about the novel to come, I just believed that it was possible. I believed that it could happen and sort of made the commitment. We made the commitment together. But it was when I did read the manuscript for the first time, I think I read it over the weekend and called you. I left this crazy message on
Ramona's. It's the best message I'll ever receive.
I had this really immersive, deep, deep, deep experience reading the book that was kind of hallucinatory. It was like a fever dream. And I kind of closed the book and I was crying, and I immediately picked up the phone and called Ramona and told her how moved I was by it. Then we did a little bit of work on it before submission, but we went out pretty quickly with it afterwards. Everything sort of accelerated once the manuscript was in, but it had been isolated from me until, you know, many drafts in.
Yeah, I had sent it out to a couple of agents. I had a story published in one story right when I finished my MFA, and I got some emails from agents. So I sent it to like two people then, and they were like, I don't know what this is at all. So then I was like, oh, okay, noted, I'll go back to work. And then I didn't want to show it to anybody. Then it was totally under lock and key. And I was so grateful that PJ was willing to work with me, even not having read it. And I felt like I'd better make this good because I don't want him to regret that decision. Good motivation.
So, Sarah, when did you enter this little family?
Well, so the genesis of Ramona being at Riverhead is actually kind of being with me is not the way it normally goes. So I had a colleague whose name was also Sarah, who was actually the person who acquired the book, and then she left Riverhead. And that is not what's unusual. Editors leave, and it's something that happens to authors, and it's called being orphaned, and it's the worst thing that can happen to you because you get inherited by someone who didn't fall in love with your book and isn't necessarily the best advocate for it. The other Sarah left shortly after acquiring the book, so it was before the editing was completed. So my publisher came to me and said, read this, you know, and I thought, there's nothing worse than working on a book that you don't believe in. And I didn't expect not to believe in it, but it's just, you know, and I had the most amazing experience because I'd been given the best gift you can be given, which is, I don't have to fight for this book, it's here, and oh my God. I remember reading it too. I just read it in one day. I was euphoric, and I so excited and also euphoric because I loved it and also grateful that I did not love it. And I absolutely would have acquired this book on my own, and that's what's fortunate. And you know, I've read in all my years being an editor, I've read a lot of books that take place during the Holocaust. But this is not a Holocaust book at all. I mean, it's, you know, it's about imagination and storytelling, and it's just...
Had the editing already begun with the...
Yeah, so I was in the middle of that draft and knew Sarah, didn't want to read it until I was done with that edit, which was really great. So I knew that I could get through this and just go on those first notes and then that we would be able to continue together. So now again, it was kind of like, all right, I better do a really good job here because I don't want her to read it and be like, oh, rats, you, huh? So, and then we worked together a little bit, but we went through, I think, maybe two sort of short revisions mm-hmm. after that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so let's establish a timeline. You interview grandmother, you start the book, you put it aside for two years, mm-hmm. you come back to it. Now, how many drafts does it go through, and at what point do you start sending it out?
I think it was, well, it was at least five drafts before I sent it to anybody, and then there was those couple people who saw it then, and then there was another, I think it was a year and a half before I sent it out again, and it was many, it was 18 drafts total, so I don't know exactly where the breakdown happened, but it was a lot of goings over.
And after when you sent it out for the first time, and then you were starting to get responses back, I guess one of the things I wonder about is the point of view in the story is, I wonder about the evolution of the point of view in the story and whether or not when you send something out into the world and then you get it back and then and someone says, well, you should do this and this and this, how do you take it? How do you know when to listen? How do you know when you say, no, this is part of who I am in this book?
That's one of the hardest things, and that the point of view was the sticky place. The book, for a long, long time, was written whole thing in first person plural, so it was all we. There was no central character. It sort of followed the main character now, but it wasn't her voice. And I think that was what people were struggling with. But it was also really important to the story. I felt like that was what made the story true, and that was what the whole book was about. So I didn't want to give it up, and I kept going back and forth with people being like, it's too hard, we don't have any footing here, and then me being like, but that's what it is, and I don't know what to tell you. And then it was that little excursion in Egypt. I had been really thinking about it and realizing that there needed to be a way to do both of those things, to get feet on the ground and to feel like you were rooted in a character and to also have it be about everybody together. And that was my job. That was going to be hard, and I needed to figure out a way to do that. So I kind of just tried an experiment of giving the whole book to Lena, who's the main character, and letting her tell parts that she wasn't there to see, and to see what that felt like. It was an experiment, and I think I was glad that it felt like it was working, and all along I wondered whether anybody would ever say, you can't, as a first-person narrator, go to all these different places and see what's happening in everybody's heads, but nobody ever said that. So I think it sort of felt that it, because I had had that plural narrator for such a long time, that voice was part of all of the writing, and it was part of the whole story. So then when Lena got to tell it, it felt natural and right, and I don't have any idea why.
Because it's interesting, because there's parts of the book where Lena's clearly present, but one part that comes through vividly for me that I remember is after the soldiers, spoiler alert, after the soldiers had discovered the village and they're running toward the river, and there's this wonderful sense of the collective and the collective voices that come, and it's still her, but it's not her.
Yeah.
And I have never really seen that. Have you seen that?
I had not, but I know that scene was really meaningful for me as well. I mean, that is one of the scenes that is most vivid, and there's something in the book and the ability to take this collective voice and give it a personal lens mm-hmm. that's both sort of inward looking but also expansive. And I mean, I think that when we had talked about the book, my experience in reading it was there's a sort of a division in the book, not even halfway, but maybe, that it felt like the kind of first part of the book was this inhale, and it just became this kind of constriction. And then it was just this rush of an exhale outward. And I think that part of that inhale was gathering all of the stories and internalizing and then pushing it back out. And it literally happens in the book. The character moves forward out of the village, but it also then becomes a more narrow lens because it becomes her. So it comes from, it became sort of the collective to the individual.
And so I also think that the reason that the perspective works, that's the kind of thing that I would chase an author about, but the whole book is about storytelling, you know, and so she's telling the story of what happens to her husband. She's not there, but she's telling the story as she sees it. It either is the way it happened or it isn't, but it doesn't matter because the whole book is about you make it true by telling the story. So it, you know, because it's part of the conceit of the entire novel, it just works.
So you'd seen the short stories, and based on the short stories, you wanted to see the manuscript. And how did you work together? Were you saying, when am I going to see the manuscript? How does that relationship work? And then once you saw the manuscript, what was the give and take between you?
It wasn't that long. We met, I think, for the first time in maybe December. And then I came back to New York again in January. Or is that right? No, did we meet only once before? Yeah. So anyway, I just felt like, oh, this is the person. There wasn't really much of a question. So then I think it was the middle of April that I sent the manuscript. So it wasn't that long. I knew that I was in the sort of end zone, and I also had a good little space of time where I had nothing else that I needed to be doing. And I worked just all day and all night, worked really, really hard for those few months to get all of the things done that were left and to make the new point of view hold together and have it be good. And then I think it was only a couple of weeks, maybe a month before it went out.
Yeah.
So we went back and forth a couple of times. But it was sort of mostly small, kind of housekeeping stuff.
So the collection was finished, and in the interim of receiving the novel manuscript, we were sending the stories out, including one submission to The New Yorker that they acquired an entire year later. Literally a year after I submitted that story, they acquired that story.
But it was perfect timing, because
the book was about to come out.
It was about to come out, and so the New Yorker, you know, anointed her and right as we were launching the novel, so it was
fun. Yeah. Yeah. I wish I had more in that timing. I think it's really just the pile of manuscripts that they go through.
Yeah.
But so the stories were ready, and then the novel came in, and we went out with it pretty quickly because I think we sold it in April.
Or May. Yeah,
and it also went very quickly within publishing. But in the same way, I mean, I think that in the same way that Ramona had to find an advocate for the work, I had to also find an advocate for the work on the publishing side. And there were people that were appropriate and responded very clearly to the book, and then others who I think also didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And that was okay. It was, you know, it's like okay for somebody not to get it, I think. And it's not unusual at all. Yeah. So then it was really finding the right advocate for it, and then we got lucky that Sarah was behind it as well.
So when you're looking for that advocate and you're describing the book, how are you describing the book?
I think I just set the scene of this isolated village and this plane flying over Mount, the bomb going up, and this body washing down the river and coming up on shore of this village, and then the story that unfolds from there. I mean, I went for the narrative, and I did not pitch it as a Holocaust book. I was very sort of careful not to do that, because I think that there's this kind of reductive thing that happens when you say the word Holocaust that people think, oh, it's going to be heavy, it's going to be sad, I've read this before, what more is there to say? And I knew that this book was doing something new in the way that it was telling the story. And the Holocaust was happening off stage. I mean, there's a very, obviously, devastating moment when the soldiers move into this village and changes the whole world of these characters. But it wasn't following what you might sort of assume you know of a typical narrative that you've heard. So I was very careful in pitching I was locating it in place. I think that we also, like when we were doing the jacket copy for the book, we were going back and forth about how much to reveal to the reader about sort of the time frame. We had to place it in time and history, but we also needed it to be the story independent of that history.
Yeah. I mean, like PJ said, that if you call it a Holocaust book, it sounds like it's going to be historically accurate, and it sounds like it's going to be dark. And though there's a lot of threatening going on in this book. It's actually, it's a book about hope, and it's a book about, you know, vision, and it's you don't want to define it in those terms. But yes, but the fact that it is, you do need to place it in history.
Yeah.
So when, Sarah, once you had the manuscript, what did your editing look like? And did your editing with Ramona differ from editing that you do with other writers?
Yeah, I talked a little bit about this at the Q&A earlier. Editing varies greatly from author to author and book to book, and even book to book with the same author, you know, a couple of times, just because of what the work is or what their work, what they're doing, what they're struggling with, what they're not struggling with. Sometimes it's, you know, really on the line level and it's, you know, touching every sentence. Sometimes it's reorganizing it or cutting it or adding a character, taking away a character. But sometimes it's really like that. Mona had it all figured out for the most part. She really, I would never mess with Mona's sentences. Maybe condensed here or there, but mostly it was just a matter of making sure, you know, that my job as an editor is largely to give the author are sort of a map of my reading experience. And so if I was confused here, you know, I might say, this would have made it clearer for me, but it doesn't really matter that you do it the way I just suggested. It's that you understand that I was confused there and you can fix it however you want, you know? So it was, you know, just making sure that everything added up.
I think that was really useful after we had worked together on it also then to get Sarah's perspective, because I think that one of the things that when we were getting it ready for submission, there's a tricky thing, which is like if you pull the wrong thread, everything unravels. Yeah. And so you have to be precise in sort of what you're doing. And it was sort of, I liked that you said that it was with Sarah about logic, because I think that the questions that you were able to ask kind of going into it were like, okay, does A actually lead to B, mm-hmm. to C to D? And kind of close those holes or not it tighter where it needed to be. But because it's such a story that is based in fable and storytelling, there was a threat of undermining the structure at any turn, really. I mean, it was sort of this precariously balanced structure of the book that you couldn't press too hard on it because you'd go through the other side.
So, Ramona, did you ever have to, were you ever in a situation where you had to make an argument for why you were doing something the way you were doing it?
I don't think so. I don't remember having to do that. No, I'm lucky that I have such good readers who understood what I was trying to do from the beginning, and we were all very much working on the same thing. So I felt just hugely grateful to have people who hadn't seen it before and were seeing it now and could tell me what it felt like and what was happening and where it was confusing and where it was holding up. And that, you know, after having worked on it mostly by myself all that time, like, oh, hi, thanks, welcome.
It's also, I was going to say, just different from my perspective of selling a book and Sarah's perspective of editing a book. So my only role is to get it into the shape that it can sell, right? And then once that happens, then I sort of recede from the relationship, and then the editor and author interaction sort of moves the book forward. So even there was on the submission, we submitted the manuscript without, it was the prologue or the letter at the mm-hmm. front. I just felt very sure that we needed to get into the story but sort of said, like, once it's sold, you know, we can put it back in. You can do whatever you want. And in fact, it went back in. I mean, I think it was something that you asked to be brought to the front. So that process just shifted from sale through edit.
Ramona, is your grandmother still alive?
She is, yes.
So I'm assuming she's read this.
She has.
And what was her reaction to it? And does she recognize her own stories in?
I think she does, yeah. I think she's really proud of me. I'm her only grandchild, so she's gotta be. And I think she also really recognizes the idea that a story that's being told stays alive. And if I wasn't gonna keep telling it, she was the end. My dad is not gonna keep this one going. So I think she was really appreciative of that. I'm glad to know that it was going. Right before the book came out, I was sort of nervous, and I asked her what her parents, who are sort of the idea for the main characters, would have thought. And she said, oh, are you kidding? They would have been so happy that you care and that you wanted to try this and make a world for them to live in. So She's been great, and she's, I was saying this before too, she's also a very prototypical Jewish grandmother, and worrying is her occupation. That's what she does all day long, and she loves it, and she's very good at it. So having a book come out leaves lots of opportunity for worrying about things. Everything could go wrong at any time. So really, it was like the best gift I could give her.
So Lena is based on your great-grandmother.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. So one of them, I briefly talked about this earlier. Lena is adopted by her aunt and uncle in the story, but this is actually what happened with your great-grandmother?
Yeah, yes.
So explain that story.
Yeah, so my great-grandmother's parents, she had a whole bunch of siblings, and her, I think it was her mother's brother, they couldn't have children. And so they just gave them one of their children, which was a thing that people did. That was part of the story that was told to me as if that was no big deal. The notes were always like, and she learned to sew, and she had, you know, elocution lessons, and learned Polish, and was like, wait, back up. They just gave her away? That doesn't seem weird at all. But actually, as in the book, they took the sister first, but in real life, they returned her because she was too stupid. And I just couldn't write that. It was too sad, so I made her too big. Yeah.
So this is one of my favorite parts of the book, and I'm sorry, this question may be incoherent because I haven't quite figured out how to answer it. I have to ask it. We talked about this earlier, but this is one of my favorite parts of the book, and it's after Lena has been adopted by her Uncle Hirsch and her Aunt Kayla, and Aunt Kayla's not altogether there, and so Lena has to grow up. I mean, she has to start from infancy again and grow up again. So the part of this passage in the book, and it's a few pages, the part in which Lena is being given words. The objects around her, her Uncle Hirsch is starting to name objects around her, and she's greedy for these words because she's keeping them because then she can use them. And so this just beautiful 3 or 4 pages in which the world is being named for her. And as she's acquiring these words, the weight of them starts to... Well, you finish this, and then I'll answer my question.
They're walking through the village, and new parents are giving her all the words and naming things, and as they go, they start to get a little heavier and lower to the ground, and eventually they have to sit down. They can't keep going under the weight of the world around them. So that's kind of what happens.
That's followed by a passage in which the committee, I can't remember the full name of the committee.
The committee for what we have and where we have it.
So they're listing the tangible items in the village, and then it moves to the intangible. And so this little section has the naming of things, attaching a name to the world around us, and then it has cataloging of things. And I wanted to ask you just about the importance of that in this story, in the story that is about the birth of a world, where that fits in this story.
I was thinking about it a lot and imagining, what if you were starting over, and what if you were just entering a place and you were in charge of it? And I think the first thing that humans do is you sort of take inventory. You figure out what you have, and you figure out where you have it, and you name it, and you give it a value, and that process is so much of how we do everything we do. My husband is a scientist, and that's his whole job, is cataloging things and naming them and assigning a value and figuring out how they do what they do. I like that in the world, and I love lists, and I love names, and I love just the words themselves. So I gravitate towards that anyway, but I was thinking about that, especially in this world, and then thinking about the same sort of counterweight of that, of the freedom that it gives you to have language and to name things and to be kind of in control of your environment. But then there you are, and you're responsible for all of it, and you have to keep track of it, and if something starts to be depleted, you have to know what to do, and if something goes missing, you have to know what to do, and all of that is kind of a responsibility that the villagers, in that scene, they're acquiring it in sort of a small and personal way, but it happens otherwise, too.
It's marvelous.
Thank you.
I think I read this in one of the interviews. You've done many, many interviews, which is fantastic, but I really liked your answer to this, and you may not answer in the same way, which is wonderful as well. But it was, I think, the Penn Center was asking you about advice that you give to emerging writers. I'd like for you to talk about that.
Sure. Well, the first thing is read all the time. That's the most important. But the second thing that I think about a lot is just to write, do you, write your work. Don't write, if somebody else can do it, writing is really hard, bless their hearts, let them take care of it. You do the thing that is that you can't not do. And a story that you would write, or a poem that you would write, whatever it is, even if no one ever read it, and you would still be grateful that you had gotten to live with that and gotten to be there in that world and make those sentences. And I think that you, the work that you make is much more interesting if you cared about it and really cared about it. Didn't think, like, I mean, I have thought sometimes, especially before, but even now, like, what would be a good book that somebody would want me to write? And then I get a good idea. I did this, I received a little fellowship when I finished graduate school, and I got this idea for a nonfiction book that I would write. I would research on this round the world trip, and I had a whole plan about it. And it was a really, I think it was a good idea. And halfway through the trip, I realized that I wanted to read the book, but I didn't want to write it at all, and that was the problem. So that just to let go of those things that you feel like some sort of like responsible for, or that you feel like you should, or that somebody might want, and do the thing that is yours to do.
That to which you have an emotional connection?
Yeah, yeah. There, another way to put it, Jim Shepherd, who's a great writer, many of you probably know him, he says, follow your weird. I love that.
So, PJ and Sarah, I have the same question for you. Advice that you would give emerging writers as well.
I would also repeat the read as much as you can, and I would add, buy it in hardcover. And if you're writing, I mean, and in, even further, if you're writing short stories, buy short stories, because you're the only ones that are buying them, or the people that are writing them. So yes, read and read and read some more, and then write, and you know, allow it to be something for you, and not necessarily for others. I mean, I think that it has to be something that is yours before it can be somebody else's. And you know, I have many writers that I work with that have written things that are in drawers, and that's not shameful, and it's part of the process. And sometimes you are able to write something and have it done and have it ready to go, but other times it's just something that needs to be written so you can write something else. So I would just also say, be patient with yourself.
Yeah, we're all saying the same thing. I'm amazed though at how many young writers I meet who tell me how much they write, and when I ask what they like to read, they don't have an answer. You know, so you can't just write, you have to read. And I think you should read what you love, but you should also read outside of that. You should, you know, ask people that you respect for suggestions, and you know, try to broaden what you read, and but then also figure out what style you love and who you want to be as a writer, and don't write it to be published. Write it because you need to write it and you want to write it. And yet most people don't publish their first thing. I mean, you should almost, like, you know, write your first book and then write your second book, and then, you know, and then maybe you'll publish both of them. But and write also. You have to write, I think, every day. I mean, you can't call yourself a writer not actually writing.
Are you writing every day?
Mostly, yes. Yeah. Some days. I have a 2-year-old, so you know, some days.
I don't mean literally every day. Rhoda, you're not a writer anymore.
It's all done. I'm cut off. But I do really try to do that. And I notice that when I stop, when I take a break for something, it's so much harder to start again. Sometimes, I mean, taking a break, my method is to go back and forth between longer stuff and shorter stuff, so I'm always working on short stories, even when I'm working on a novel, which I'm doing both of those right now, and I find that I'm working along on the novel, and I get somewhere, and I'm like, okay, so this is what this is, and then I come up against a wall, and I'm like, okay, I don't know what to do. First of all, go for a walk, try again, but then if that doesn't work, then I'll put it down for a little while, but I don't like to be idle, because I think it makes me, well, it makes me nervous, and it also makes me less good at what I do. So then I go and I work on a short story and try to figure that out, and then when I get to the wall there, then I go back to the novel, and I think they sort of rescue each other, because by the time I come back, I'm like, oh, okay, I can figure out one thing to do here at least.
So in between the going back and forth between the novel and the short story, are you reading all along the way as well?
Yes, always, yeah.
And then do you ever find the authors insinuated in
people? I feel like people are always worried about that. I remember I taught a class at Irvine, and the person who, it was in a different department, so a new person was kind of supervising, and she looked at my syllabus, and one of the assignments was to imitate one of the writers we'd read, And she was really nervous about it and was not comfortable at all and said, I don't like that. I think we need to be encouraging them to find their own voices. And like, that's how you do it. You have to let it, to see what happens, try on some different things and see what it feels like. And you will fail at imitation. It won't work. It can't work. You know, you just can't. It's not how it works. So you have your own mind. But you kind of find your way through by letting those voices get inside of you. So I don't worry ever about having, you know, trying to be somebody else. And I do feel like, instead, that I try to be influenced by everything I read in some way. And to let influence be a good thing, and let it, even things that are very different from what I write, or that are thematically different, or language level different, whatever it is, to just let it all kind of find a place. And the more, the better. And that's part of where the accumulation is good, because you've just got a lot of different voices with you all the time.
I also read that you write in blocks, mm-hmm. so that you move your blocks around. What was your first, the first block that came to you? Where did it end up? Did it end up in your
I think, yeah, I think probably so. I think, I'm trying to remember exactly, but the first, the whole new world thing didn't occur until the second draft. So the first block, I think actually was probably that adoption section. So I knew that the character was going to be adopted by her aunt and uncle, and so the first section was all about the family as it was, and then the transfer. And that, I mean, it's a little, I'm sure it's changed from the beginning, but the essential part of it is the same.
So as you were writing, it's not a matter of writing the first sentence.
Oh, then Lord, no.
Act of faith is going to carry you through your writing.
I can't. There are those writers who write one sentence, and when it's perfect, then they move on to the next sentence. And when that's perfect, they write the third sentence. And that is amazing to me. And I do not work that way at all. So yeah, I make a big mess. Figure out where the heartbeat is, and then start moving things around. And yeah.
Again, thank you so much. That was a wonderful conversation. I really
appreciate it. Thank you.